It's in pretty good focus. All right, what I want to do today is, this is perhaps more of a Bible study format than anything else, but thought it would be good to go through, since I'm going to be making this trip pretty soon, to talk a little bit about the nation of Jordan. If you know anything about the nation of Jordan, we have a program over there, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. I'm going to be making a trip over Unleavened Bread to visit the five volunteers that are in Jordan, plus several other people that seem to show up whenever we have a minister that goes over there. There are people from other fellowships, et cetera, that meet with us. So we probably will end up with 10 to 12 people for Passover service and Night to be Much Observed. I'm going to spend a few days in Amman and going to go to the Amman Baccalaureate School as well as the Bunyat Center where we have volunteers. And then there is a good chance that I'm going to meet with the royal family while I'm there. So I would ask that you pray about that, I don't say anything that goofs up our relationship with them. And they're pretty nice. I actually have met not the crown prince, but the king's brother. I don't know if that's called a crown prince or not, but anyway, the king's brother I've met. And it's his wife that sponsors our group to go over there, Princess Sarbath. So there is a good opportunity that I might be meeting with the princess when I'm over there. The last time that Mr. Horchek was over there, or no, I think it was actually Clyde Kylo. I think the king actually walked through the room and walked up and introduced himself. So you never know. It'll be interesting to see. And then after that, then we're going to take the group and we're going to go across into Israel, into Galilee, and spend some time around the Sea of Galilee, Tiberias region, maybe even getting as far as Megiddo. So for those of you that have never seen Armageddon, it's a really interesting place to see. And hopefully I'll come back with some pictures and maybe we can have a round two of this after I get back. But what I wanted to do today is go through and talk about this nation. I want to give a quick overview of the geography and how it plays into biblical events. There's a lot in the Bible about the nation of Jordan. Now, you're not going to find the word Jordan in there. They're called something different. Why do a study on Jordan? You know, a lot of people, how many of you have ever just traveled overseas, let alone gone to Jordan? How many of you have been out of the country? How many of you have ever been in Jordan? Okay, several. Good. Only 3% of the U.S. population has passports. There are a lot of people that just don't travel. In fact, I have met several people that have never gone. The furthest they have ever gone is maybe 15 or 20 miles away from where they were born. They just have never traveled. And they come into the church and they go to the Feast of Tabernacles, and that's like, wow, you're going all the way to Orange Beach? You know, it just seems incredible for people that just don't travel. Only 15% of our elected U.S. officials have passports, if you can believe that. There's just not a lot of knowledge about this. Again, not all of the modern names reflect the ancient biblical stories, but as we go through this, what I want to do is understand the history of this vital region. And I'm going to take you on a little tour from the time of Abraham through the time when Israel conquers the area of Canaan, and how the Jordanian country today plays into that story. There's so much written in the Bible about this region that if you don't know about it, you wouldn't know that that's what's being talked about. And I want to make sure that we understand that, because there's some prophecies that are going to play into that later on. I'm going to give you a little tour. Marlis and I went there for the feast in 2005. Pat Simon and I went about a year ago, I guess. I have a lot of pictures from the feast in 2005 that I want to show you, and it'll give you an idea of that region. And then I want to end it with talking about Bible prophecies for this region. There are a lot of prophecies about this area in the end time. Some that, if you are listening to Ralph Levy's section or FI class on the book of Genesis, he actually talked about one area here as a has always been of special interest to the Church of God. I'll talk about that a little bit as well. Just to give you some background as to the area that I'm talking about, I brought my laser pointer today. The nation of Jordan is right here. Israel is right beside it, separated by the Jordan River. And then I want you to get an idea of the area surrounding it, because it's going to play into when Abraham is told to go to the Promised Land. Pre-patriarchal, this area down here, Ur of the Chaldees. You'll remember that that's where Abraham started when he was probably a young man with his father. He was down here in this area, and God told him, I want you to go to the land of Canaan. Now, if you're a smart person and you think, well, the closest way from point A to point B is a straight line, you would not be a smart person if you lived in this area, because a straight line from Ur of the Chaldees to Canaan is across the Arabian Desert. I'm going to show you some pictures of what that looks like. You would not want to cross the Arabian Desert. That's not where you go. And if you'll notice the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, this is where all of the population is. And so for Abraham to get to Canaan, he had to go up to Haran and then down. And we're going to follow his footpaths all the way up there. And that is an area called the Fertile Crescent. Now, you perhaps have heard of that term. And what that means is this is the area where all of the population, where all of the water, and where all of the vegetation is. And the rest of it is just pure desert. In fact, the majority of the nation of Israel, if you were to go over there and look at it, especially if you go down south into the Negev, that is just dry as a bone. Very, very dry. There's a story that we were told when we went to the feast. I don't know how true this is, but I really kind of think that it probably is true. There was a time when in northern Jordan, there were a lot more trees than there are today, and therefore there was a lot more vegetation, a lot more water, etc. But one of the sultans that came along got this idea of taxing trees. For every tree that you had in your yard, you had to pay a tax. Well, guess what everyone did? They cut down their trees. And it ended up completely changing the landscape, and the area became basically a desert because of this very bad decision by an unwise ruler. Not that we ever have any bad decisions from unwise rulers today, but that was what happened in this area. Just to give you a little bit of background again, and when you read through the Bible, this area of Jordan, especially right up in here, was ruled before Israel got there and before Abraham got there, was ruled by three different peoples, and you'll read about them in the Bible. I'll actually read one example of that in Deuteronomy 3 in just a moment. But there were people here that were called the Rephaim or the Emim, and they were giants. Giants, you know, relative term, but they were big, big, big people. Reading from Deuteronomy 3 and verse 11, I'll just read this to you. This is from the Revised Standard Version. In the 14th year of the king who were with him came and subdued the Rephaim. Oh, sorry, this is Genesis 14, verse 5. So the Rephaim were subdued. For only Og, the king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim. And behold, his bedstead was a bedstead of iron. Is it not in Rabbah of the Ammonites? 9 cubits in length. So his bed was 13 feet long. That's how tall he was. He needed a bed big enough to fit his frame. So, you know, you can just imagine a Shaquille O'Neal or whatever at 7+ feet or 8 feet. They need long beds or they'd be half hanging out on the end. So this king was so large, he had a special bed made for him. So if you can imagine such a thing. The Rephaim or the Emim were warrior giants that were in the area. About the time of Abraham, they lived on the east side of the Jordan River. And the peoples of Abraham are going to end up taking over this area in a little while, and we'll read about that. I wanted to show you a picture of this. This is what the Arabian Desert looks like. This is a view from Petra or near Petra facing east. So again, if you were to think about where Ur of the Chaldees is and go due west of Ur of the Chaldees, you would virtually run into Petra if you could walk straight west. That's what you would have. You'd have mountains, and that is all basalt or volcanic rock. That whole area is just littered with it, and it is hot and very unpleasant, and there is zero water. You know, you talk about oases and things like that. This area really doesn't have much. And so when you see a map, like the map I showed you before, nobody lives there. There are camels that can cross it, but it's very tough. And there's another way to get around in the area. There's this very narrow strip of land. If I put this map up here, this is the map of Jordan. You can see where the vegetation is, and it's all right down the center where the Jordan River is. You get a few miles away from the Jordan River, and you don't have much in the way of vegetation at all. Similar to Egypt, you get the Nile was the lifeblood of Egypt, and you get a few miles away from the Nile, and you were back into desert again. So this area, Amman, is right here. This is the capital. And from north to south, we're going to visit some of these places along this road that was right here was called the King's Highway. You will see that in Scripture as well, that the children of Israel went up the King's Highway when they came out of Egypt. So anyway, we'll show you more of this area as we go. Give you an idea of Abraham and his journey. You can see I've kind of superimposed the nation of Jordan here. So Abraham starts in Ur of the Chaldees. We'll read this in just a moment with a couple of scriptures. He goes up through Nineveh and ends up staying in Haran for a while. And then from Haran, he ends up going down into the land of Canaan. You're going to see three different routes here, and I know it's a little hard to see, but he's got his original journey when Jacob left, and then when Rebekah it comes back to visit with Isaac. So this whole area is covered in this the journeys of Abraham. Let's read a little bit about it here. Genesis chapter 13 in verse 3, it says, "When Abram went on his journey from the south, he went as far as Bethel." And I want to show that to you on a picture, and I'm going to make a couple of comments here. This is just... can I get focused just a little bit more? It just seems a little out of focus for me. Shane, if you can help out. It's kind of hard to see, but there, that's better. All right, if you can see it, there's Bethel is right there, and it's just north of Jerusalem. It's actually just a few miles north of Jerusalem. So it says that Abram went south as far as Bethel. Now, I want to just comment about something that you read in the Bible. Sometimes we just read right over that, and we don't think about what it is that's being said here. I want to remind you of something. I don't have a slide on this, but in Genesis chapter 28, verses 18 and 19, something occurs in this area, and this is Abraham's grandson, Jacob. I wanted to just read this to you. Genesis 28, verses 18 and 19. It says, "Then Jacob arose in the morning. He took the stone that he had put by his head. He set it up as a pillar and poured oil on top of it." Verse 19, "And he called the name of the place Bethel." So it was Jacob that named this. And yet, here we see in Genesis 13, it says that Abraham went to Bethel. Abraham could not have gone to Bethel because Bethel didn't exist. The name Bethel happened later. When Moses wrote the first five books of the Old Testament, he was using words that he knew at the time. So Abraham stopped in the area that became Bethel, but he didn't say it like that. There are some people that are critical of the Bible, and they say, well, that Bethel didn't exist, therefore this whole story is false. No, the story isn't false. It would be very much like saying to someone, you know, well, where did the British, when they came up and they fought the Battle of New Orleans, where was that? And you would say, well, it was in Chalmette. Well, I'll bet you the term Chalmette didn't exist at the time that that happened. But we just reference it today because that's what everyone knows it as. And that's very similar to what we have here. So you're going to find place names in the Bible maybe didn't happen until later on. But it's important for the rest of the story to know where Abraham settled. He settled in Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan. Again, here's the Jordan River, and we're going to talk about this area over here in just a moment. Go further in Genesis chapter 13 in verse 8. It says, "So Abram said to Lot, 'Please let there be no strife between you and me and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is it not the whole land before you? Separate from me. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, then I will go to the left.'" So Lot and Abram both have lots of herds. They have lots of servants. They have lots of people that they're taking care of. And they got to the place where they started fighting over water rights, etc. So it's important for them to be able to separate. And notice where they go. Genesis 13 and verse 10. "Then Lot lifted his eyes and saw all of the plain of Jordan. Now remember where they are. They're in Bethel. So if he lifts his eyes and looks to the plain of Jordan, where is he looking? He's looking over here. So there's a mountain range here, and then there's a valley area right here. He saw the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered. That makes sense because it has the Jordan River. If you're not around the Jordan River, there's not a lot of water. That it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. I'll show you some pictures of where many scholars think Sodom was. I actually was able to tour the area and have some pictures. Before God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, it was like the garden of the Lord, like the Garden of Eden, like the land of Egypt as you go toward Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all of the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east. So the man Lot and all of his retinue went east to the plain. The word plain in Hebrew means a bowl. It's a low area. And if you go down into this, that's exactly what it is. There's a mountain range here on this side. There's a mountain range on this side. And you go down to the Jordan River, and then that's where the waters were. Sodom and Gomorrah. I'll, again, show you pictures in just a little while. Nobody knows where Sodom and Gomorrah is exactly. The Bible has a lot of words about it. They talk about the story of it being destroyed, and yet no one really has any idea where it is except for some archaeological excavations that are happening. So some Bible maps, and you may have Bible maps in your Bible if you look in the back, they used to think that Sodom and Gomorrah were on the south side of the Dead Sea down here. And you can even see that this says Zoar. You see that in when they mention as you go towards Zoar. But when it says that Abraham and Lot were in Bethel and he went east toward the area that became Sodom and Gomorrah, the scholars started looking in this area and they think now that they have found it. And again, I'll show you some pictures of that in just a while. I wanted to show this. I think like this. The rest of the world probably doesn't. I have talked with the Cunninghams and all of the families that I have to draw a family tree to figure out who's related to who. I have actually done that with your family, so that I didn't show that up here. But I wanted to show this because there are three different nations that are going to come out of this that are important. So we start with Terah. This is the father of Abraham. And we know that Terah had at least two wives. How do we know that? Because when Abraham married Sarah, he said that Sarah was his half-sister. So Abraham and Sarah had the same father, but they had different mothers. So Terah at least had two wives. We know that the children of Terah, he had Haran, Nahor, Abram, and Sarah. Sarah and Abram end up getting married, and they have Isaac and Ishmael. Haran gets married, and he has Lot. I'll read the story just briefly. I don't want to get too graphic because you know the story of Lot and how his children came about. We'll read that in just a minute. But of the children of Lot, you have Moab and Ammon, and they became the nations of Moab and Ammon, and you'll see them on a map in just a moment. Also, if you come down here to Isaac, Isaac marries Rebekah. This is actually his first cousin. There was a lot of familial marrying back in those days. Isaac and Rebekah have twins, Esau and Jacob, and Esau becomes the nation of Edom. All of these play into who modern-day Jordan is. So you've got to know the biblical names to be able to find the prophecies that talk about them. And then you see that Jacob married Rachel and Leah. So again, he would have married his first cousin. And then they had the 12 tribes of Israel from them. So Moab, Ammon, and Edom all come through the line of Terah. And let's see where they went. In Genesis chapter 19, and you can see the kingdom of Ammon, the kingdom of Moab, the kingdom of Edom, and this is modern day Jordan right through here. Genesis 19, verse 36. Says, both the daughters of Lot were with child by their fathers. You remember they got him drunk, and a terrible story. It's just interesting listening to Ralph Levy go through that. And so gingerly reading it, saying some of these are really hard to read, but it's in the Word of God, so we study it. It says, the firstborn, so that one of the daughters of Lot, bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami. He is the father of the people of Ammon to this day. So when Lot left this area of Beth-El and went east, he settled in this area where Sodom and Gomorrah are. And when his children spread out, they became the children of Moab and Ammon. Again, the Jordan River, this is where all the water is, so they would have stayed pretty close to this area. Now let's go on a little further. Genesis chapter 38, verse 6. It says, then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughter, and all the persons of his household, and his cattle, and all his animals, and his goods which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and he went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. Where was Jacob? Jacob was in this area up here. He didn't want to be near Jacob anymore because, again, there just wasn't enough land. So it says that he traveled south to Seir, or Seir, which is down in here, and that becomes the kingdom of Eden. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir, and Esau is Edom. So the southern part of Jordan is where the people of Esau settled. The middle and northern part of Jordan is where the children of Lot settled. So they are relatives of the nation of Israel. They're cousins, you might say. Maybe third, fourth, fifth cousins, but cousins nonetheless. Do you all get along with all of your cousins? Are your relatives just all one big happy family? You're going to find that these weren't either. And in fact, they were so much not so that God actually made some prophecies about Edom and Moab and Ammon because of the hostility that they showed the nation of Israel. All right, I wanted to show this picture here, and then we'll read a little bit about this. This is later on when Israel goes into captivity, and they are down in Egypt. You can see all the Nile River, and then it spreads up into this delta. This is an area where a lot of people settled. This is an area where they think the land of Goshen was. That's where the Israelites were. And it says here that when they left, they went down this is this dotted line here. They went to Mount Sinai. I actually don't believe Mount Sinai is there. I think it's over here. But anyway, they traveled from here. And then you're going to see they go up to Kadesh. And then something happens in Kadesh that causes them to have to come back down again to what today is called the Gulf of Aqaba. And then you're going to see them making this journey up the King's Highway. We'll follow that. So after the children of Israel go into Egypt because of the drought, they are detained there by a new Pharaoh and become slaves. During the time of the Exodus, when they leave, this area seemed to have been pretty heavily populated. You read in Numbers 20 that Israel finds Edom a fully organized state with a king, and they ask permission, and we'll show that in just a moment. They ask permission from the king of Edom to be able to travel through. Now think of who Edom is. It's like their second or third cousin, and they know that. Edom knows that, and so does Israel, and yet they are denied a route through Edom, and Edom is this entire area. So Edom would be this entire area right here. So what Israel does is they end up going back to the Gulf of Aqaba and then skirting around the side of Edom because Edom won't let them through. Then they get to the area of Moab and Ammon and ask them for safe passage, and they're denied it again. We'll read that as we go. Show you a picture here. This is the King's Highway. You'll read about this in history. You also read it in the Bible. This is the one way of getting north and south through the land of Israel and Jordan. It's right in the Jordan Valley. If you look at this, this is a road that Pat and I traveled when we went down to Petra. It's a modern freeway system now. Back in the day, it would have been a sandy road that camels and donkeys would have ridden down. Lining both sides of this 335-kilometer thoroughfare is a rich chain of archaeological sites that read like an index of ancient history. Pat and I went and visited Petra. We'll show that to you in just a moment. There are so many more there. The tomb of Aaron is near Petra, where they think that Aaron was buried. The area where Moses struck the rock And I'll show you pictures of that area as well. The area where Moses died, all of that is along this King's Highway. So when we get there, we'll read that. From south to north, we have the children of Israel that are walking up there. And as they walk up there, we're going to follow them. Let's read about it in Numbers chapter 20. Now Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom and said, "Thus says your brother Israel." Have you ever done that? Hi, relative. I'm going to borrow some money, and I just want you to remember that your mom and my mom were cousins, or were brother and sister, or whatever. They've got something that they want. Thus says your brother Israel, "Let us pass through your country. We will not pass through the fields or vineyards, nor will we drink water from the wells." I don't know how he could say that with a straight face. They obviously had to drink water, but he promised them they wouldn't. We will go along the king's highway. In other words, we're going to just go right up that road. We won't be bothering anyone. We won't turn aside from the right hand or to the left until we have passed through your territory. But he, the king of Edom, said, "You will not pass through." So Edom came out against them with many men and a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory. So Israel turned away from him and went back south. And then, as you saw on that map, they had to skirt around to the side. So as they go up the King's Highway from south to north, we're going to follow that trail. I'm going to show you pictures all along the way. So here's what we're going to see as we go through more of this. We're going to see the nation of Jordan through the eyes of Petra. We're going to visit Petra. If you've been in the Church of God a long time, you know what Petra is all about. There was, back in the 50s and 60s, there was a concerted idea in the church that this would be the place of safety. I remember Dr. Hay wrote an article back when I was first in the church, and the article was entitled, "We're Visiting Petra." And then he went, and then when he came back, he wrote a second article and said, "We fled Petra," because it was not a nice place. After you get there and you realize, boy, if we have to spend 3.5 years in this place, this is going to be pretty tough. I'll show you some pictures of what that's like. It's beautiful, but I wouldn't want to spend 3.5 years there if I don't have to. But if that's where God chooses to take us, that's where he chooses to take us. There is a scripture in the Old Testament that talks about the area of Petra. Another name for it is Selah, S-E-L-A. And it talks about, "Hide my outcasts in Selah." And so the church took that and said, well, perhaps what that's saying is that when the church flees, they would go and be protected in a place called Selah. I actually remember Mr. Armstrong writing a letter one time and saying, "My knowing the king of Jordan may save your life someday." That was a veiled reference to going to Petra. We'll show pictures of that. Then north of that is Mount Nebo. We're going to go see Mount Nebo. This is the area where Moses was taken up to the mountain and shown Israel, but wasn't allowed to go into Israel, and he died on Mount Nebo. We'll go a little further to the west, and we'll show you the Dead Sea. If you've never been to the Dead Sea, that is one of the most interesting places I have ever been, and I'll explain why when we get there. We'll go a little further than that to Ammon. This is the capital of, again, the ancient nation of Ammon. There are a lot of places up here that where if you read about Rabbah in the Bible, this is the area around Ammon. That's where our volunteers are. I'll show you some pictures of there. And then we'll go a little bit further north to Jerash. I'll show you some pictures. And then finally up to Pella. And we'll read something very interesting. You talk about a place of safety. Pella was actually a place of safety for the Church of God in the 80s and 90s A.D., after Jerusalem fell. And we'll read about that when we get there. So here is a map of Petra. That's a very bad map. I'm sorry. It shows up better on a real flat white screen. But this area of Petra, everything that you see here that's dark are cliffs, straight up. This is an area that's sandstone, and over the years and years and years of water running, it has carved canyons, very much like what you would see the Grand Canyon when you go there. To have a picture of the Grand Canyon does nothing compared to standing on the rim and looking down and seeing this massive wall. You walk into Petra through this really small area here. This is called the Sikh. which is Arabic for the key. It's very narrow. There's hundreds of feet tall. And so if you are an invading army, that's your only way in. And what the people that lived, the Nabataeans that lived in Petra, they would just stand up on the top of these hills and throw boiling oil and stuff down on advancing troops. And they've got a 15 or 20 foot wide narrow corridor that runs for about a mile. And that's the only way in. So I'll show you pictures of the Sikh. We get down here. This is the Treasury Building, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the building for Raiders of the Lost Ark. That's where that is. Then I'll show you some pictures in the central area here. The tomb of the royals is down in here. And then we'll finally end up at the monastery, which is the picture that was at the very front slide. I should have pointed that out, but we'll show you pictures of the monastery. So let's take a quick tour of Petra. This is, and again, it's kind of hard to see, but this is the Sikh or the key. You imagine this. This is only 10 or 15 feet wide, and it goes up for several hundred feet. And these are cliffs on either side where the armies of the Nabataeans would sit up there and then throw water or boiling oil or something down on advancing armies. So you go down this. When we went, this was, by the way, this was our tour guide. That's Firas, if you remember. You remember him? He was our tour guide there. And they would take us down, and you walk forever. I mean, it just seems like, when are we ever going to get to this place? Because you think of Petra as some small place. Petra is like dozens, if not tens of dozens of miles of territory. And so you go through, and as you go through the Sikh, then you end up, at the end of it, you end up seeing the Treasury Building. So what they did for us is, we're going down the Sikh, and it's just winding along, and then at some point, the tour guide says, "Now I want you to all turn around and look up," and he shows us some imaginary figure that we're supposed to see on the wall, and he says, "Now if you walk back, you'll see it a little clearer." So we're walking backwards, and then he says, "Okay, well there's really nothing there. Now turn around," and then you see the Treasury Building, and it is really quite spectacular to be walking through this, and then all of a sudden walk into the Treasury. Again, this is the building that was used in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they would go in to get the Ark of the Covenant, etc. Actually, this is nothing more than just something cut into the facade. You can actually see it. This is the treasury right here. This is just a side of a mountain, and some people cut this building out of the side of a mountain. So what they would do is they would have come up to this level up here, and they would have bored holes and put a wood platform and then stood on that platform and started carving. And then they could reach down and drill holes and then move that platform down and keep drilling, keep drilling, keep drilling. Some of the drill holes you can still see. Again, this is not a very clear picture, but you can still see some drill holes over here on the side where they just carved this out of the side of a mountain. And then this area here is nothing more than a room that's maybe 10 by 20, and it was a tomb. So, you know, on Raiders of the Lost Ark, he walks in there, and it's this building, this labyrinth that goes back forever. Well, that's Hollywood. All this is just a facade for some king that had that for him as a royal tomb. Give you an idea of the massive structure of this. This is the door, and this is this. Can you just imagine being someone with a hammer and chisel, and that's all they've got, and they're carving this massive thing out of stone? And that is everywhere. If you go through Petra, I'm going to show you some other pictures here. It's just enormous what these people were able to do with a hammer and chisel. And they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. And you see this this grate right here? Just a couple of years before we went in 2005, they didn't know that there was anything else down there, but they started to do some excavation and found out that's looking down that grate. There is another building underneath the building that's on top of the building. Back in the days of the Nabataeans, it would have been, the ground level would have been even lower. It is estimated that less than 30% of Petra has been unearthed. The rest of it is still underground. There's so much more to be discovered there, and it's everywhere. When Pat and the guys were traipsing off, I, as the old man, stayed back to make sure that everybody was safe, because I couldn't stay up with them. In fact, I think Pat almost lost his wind there a couple of times. But while I was staying there, I met a local, and I just said, "You know, how easy is it to find coins and all that?" He goes, "Come here." So he took me around the corner and he just said, just walk along this path. And we walked along. We start picking Nabataean coins up, thousands of years old. They're everywhere. Pottery, everywhere. Just kick your feet and you're going to pull up pottery. Because this was a town that was had perhaps 50, 60,000 people lived in Petra at one point in time. It's huge. Going a little further, this is the royal tombs. Again, this is the treasury would be off to the left, and we're going along this path here, and then we're going to go out to the monastery. These are other buildings that are carved in there, and these are all for tombs. So if you were wealthy enough to afford it, you could say, well, you know, I want to have a really nice tomb, so somebody would you would hire somebody, and they would take hammer and chisel, and they would go carve you out a tomb. So that's what this area is. I have a book that I intended to bring with me, but I left it with Tom and Linda Diaz, and so I'll bring it one of these days, but it shows a picture of what this area looked like. They had a waterway system where they could gather water from 100 miles away down pipes and into Petra, and they actually had water gardens and fountains and all of that at the height of the Nabataean kingdom, where there was just this amazing plethora. They had palm trees in there and all that. Well, that's all gone now because once the Nabataeans left, it all dried up. But they have an amazing way of being able to get things around there. I show this picture. This is our daughter and son. This is Emily and Justin. It's said there are only three ways to travel in Petra: by donkey, by camel, or by sandal. And that is very true. You get down into Petra, and they have all these boys that have camels or donkeys, and for a few dinar, you can get on and ride up to some of these places. I don't have all of the pictures to show you. If you'd be interested, I'll show them to you one of these days. OSHA would have a field day. They would have a fit over there. You're traveling up the side of a mountain. The path is 3 foot wide. There's no rail, and the drop-off is 3,000 feet. And you can just look over the edge and think, how do, and I asked the guy, I said, well, how many people die here? And he goes, oh, 4 or 5 a year fall off these things. Because when it rains, I mean, it gets slippery. So anyway, if heights is not your thing, I wouldn't go there. But it is truly amazing. Here's a picture of the monastery. Again, this is a tomb. This room is probably a 20 by 20. It's got some ornate carvings and decorations inside. It's very pretty. But this is just carved out of a mountain. I've got another picture of this that I'll show in just a moment. But you can even see that it's carved out of the mountain. There's a wall on this side and a wall on this side. And this was a mountain that came down, and they just carved back into it and cut this face. You used to be able to walk up and sit right up here. They don't allow that anymore because they've had so many deaths that they don't allow people up there. You still can get up there if you bypass there's like stanchions around that try and keep you out, but there's no guards there, so you can get around. But seeing it from the air, this is it. This is the monastery. You can see how it's just been cut out of the side of a mountain. And again, you can keep going. This is probably 2 or 3 miles from the entrance, and it is. There's another 10, 12, 15 miles beyond that of building after building after building after building. You would, if you wanted to see everything in Petra, you'd have to be there for a week or 10 days of just constant travel. Most people go there and just spend a day. Again, the Hebrew word for Petra is Sela. The Greek word is Petra, so you see Petra today because of the influence of the Greeks. But Sela is Arabic and Hebrew for rock or rock clef. The Edomites were here in the 7th century, but it was already built by the time the Edomites came there. The ancient Nabataeans were the ones the Nabataeans came in after the Edomites. So around the 4th century BC, the Nabataeans move in. They're the ones that really made it into this spectacular city. We do know from history the Nabataeans didn't write anything down, so all that we have is just folklore. But they were sun god worshipers, and they were a nomadic tribe that came from Arabia. So this is Petra. This is the area where some in the church have thought for years that this would be the place of safety. I'm telling you, there is nothing there but rock and empty tombs. So, again, if God wants us there, he'll send us there. But I would rather have a Howard Johnson's somewhere if I had my say-so in it. All right, let's go a little further north. This is Mount Nebo. Everything up there has been built around activities that happened. I should have pointed it out, and I didn't, but the area around Petra has the Tomb of Aaron, and it has Wadi Musa, which is the area where Moses struck the rock. All of that is around Petra. So you read all those stories about ancient Israel and striking the rock and water coming out of the rock. That's all in the area of Petra. This is a little further north. This is Mount Nebo. So if you read the story, again, in Deuteronomy chapter 34, it says, "Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah," which is this ridge where this building is, "which is across from Jericho. And the Eternal showed him all of the land of Gilead as far as Dan." So from the top of a mountain, he is in on the Jordan side of the Jordan River, and he goes up to this mountaintop, and God says, "Because you struck the rock twice and didn't do what I say, you can't go in to the land, but I want you to see it." So Moses goes up on the top of this hill, and I'll show you some pictures of what he would have seen without the smog. There's a lot of smog there today and dust and stuff, but he probably would have seen it clearly. You can see Dan, all of Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all of the land of Judah as far as the western sea. You can see all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. To the south, to the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. Then the Eternal said to him, "This is the land which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to your descendants, and I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over there." So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab on the top of this mountain, according to the word of the Lord, and he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, opposite from Beth Peor, but no one knows his grave to this day. So Moses was on the top of Mount Nebo when he died, and then an angel would have taken his body and buried it. So this is an area where Moses would have looked out. There's a sign up there, and from the sign you can see, this looks like it says MTN for mountain. It's actually Mount Nebo and a Christian cross. They assume if you're a student of the Bible, you must be a Christian and you must want a cross. Everywhere that you go, they sell crosses. I mean, it's just, after a while, you just think, boys, how can they make any money? After a while, you would think everybody in the planet would have a cross because there's just millions of them there. But from there, you can see Hebron, the Herodium, which would have been a Roman place. Bethlehem, it's hard for me to see from here. Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. I'll show you some of those in just a moment. Jerusalem, Ramallah, Jericho, which would have been right across the water. Remember when where the land of Israel started, when they went across to the Jordan River, what was the first place they went to? Jericho, and they took that city out. So you actually can see Jericho from this area, and I'll show you a picture. Lake Tiberias, which is where we're going to be going with the students. You can see up to the Sea of Galilee and all the way to Nablus. So this is all seeable from this area. So here's, again, is a picture from Mount Nebo. This is the Dead Sea. Again, a very bad picture on a very, very cloudy day. There's a mountain range back here that you can't see. I'm sorry. I wish I had a clearer picture. And Jerusalem sits on the top of a mountain. So Jerusalem is right out here. And you can look right across. This is the Jordan River. You can look right out across the Jordan River, and right in this area is Jericho. And I've got a better picture of that coming up next. So Moses would have been able to see the first conquest from where they would have just crossed over and forded the Jordan River. Here's a better picture of it. This is, again, the Jordan River is down here, and this is the area of Jericho. So the Israelites would have been able to have seen it if they had climbed up the mountain. I'm assuming that some of them did. And Moses probably gave them instructions, when you go over, here's what you're going to do. And so they would have taken over this area of Jericho, which is in the valley just off of the Jordan River. Another picture of it. Again, this is the area where ancient Jericho would have been. And they've got some sites there. Qumran is just a little south of this. So you can see Qumran down there as well. You may have seen pictures of this before. The locals there are Bedouins, and they, in essence, they own the place. I mean, the Jordanians and the Bedouins are not from the same stock of people, but because the Bedouins were there before Ammon and Moab and Edom came through, they are allowed to stay there. They can cross from one side to the other without passports. They live in tents. This would have been very much the way Abraham would have lived. He would have lived in tents as a herder of sheep. He would have been a nomad like this, where he would have just gone from place to place. This is how Abraham would have lived. The difference today is these people are very, very wealthy. They just choose to live like this because that's what they've always done. They drive Mercedes-Benz. They have cell phones. They have satellite dishes that they take with them when they go from place to place. They set their tents up. They set their satellite dish up. They park their Mercedes outside. They're very wealthy people, but this is their tradition. In fact, the Bedouins are the ones that run Petra. When you go into Petra, if you just sit down and talk to some of the locals, they are Bedouins that live in the area. Some of them that live in Petra in tents. I talked with one of them, asked him about finding some coins, some Nabataean coins. I have one. I should have brought it with me. And he took me down to an area where we could search for coins, and there were some Bedouin tents in the background. And everybody knows everybody down there. They all live in that area. Leaving Mount Nebo and going down to the Dead Sea, we were warned before we went down there, don't shave. Ladies, don't shave. Men, don't shave. So why? Because you're going into salt water, and it is a heavy concentration of salt, and you will be burnt to the place where we will have to take you to the hospital. Do not shave. So guess what I did? Shaved. I did. I got down in the water and got my face in that salt water and thought I was going to die. If you ever go, don't shave. Listen to the locals. They know. This is an area where the Jordan River goes into it, but there's no exit. So as water goes in and it evaporates, what's left is salt. Here's a picture of just, you can just reach down with your hand and pick out salt. And this is a salt crystal that's buried in the mud. All along the shores of the Dead Sea are stores that sell this mud, this salt mud, because it is very good for the skin if you got the right concentration of it. So they sell these beauty products that have this oil and mud, and you can put it on like a mask and then let it sit, and then when you take it off, it's just supposed to be wonderful, whatever. I didn't try that because I had shaved that day. But there's salt everywhere. And this is what people do. They will go down there and they will reach down. You walk into the water and you sink about 4 or 5 inches into just clay. And you can reach down and pick that up and you can put it all over your body. And then all along the shore, they have places where you can, like outdoor showers, where you can go and then wash this mud off before you go back into your cars. And then plenty of people there hoping that you'll buy some salt mud to take back home with you. In fact, I think there probably is a thriving industry. You probably could buy some of this online. It's just I couldn't guarantee that it really comes from there. For all I know, someone in Paducah, Kentucky is making it in his backyard. It's kind of hard to know. But anyway, this was one of our people that were there during the feast. I can't remember his name, but his wife was getting him all mudded up here. To where you end up just completely covered from head to foot. And then when you rinse it off, it really does feel, I mean, I didn't do it on my face, but I did it on my arms and things. It does feel kind of good, I suppose. I'm not into that sort of thing, but if you are. This is an example. They have newspapers sitting around. It is impossible to sink. The salt content is such that I don't care if you're a buoyant person or not. When you lay down in the salt sea, you just, 3/4 of your body is out of the water, and there is nothing you can do. You cannot sink. You can't even, which is good, because I laid back and had my picture taken with a newspaper, which I did not show you that picture. Since I had shaved that day, I didn't want to get my face that wet, but this is what you do. You just lay back, and then you just float on the top as if you've got floaties on. It's just impossible to sink. A lot of fun, so people will go there and spend the day. All right, this is going further on to the city of Amman. This is the one and only major place. Almost everybody, I'm going to guess here, probably 85 or 90% of the people of Jordan live in Amman. It's a huge city. Similar if you go to Mexico, Mexico City just goes on forever and ever and ever, and that's the city of Amman. This picture is very similar to where our students live. If you go up to the roof, Pat, I think you went up there and you look out over the city of Amman. It's decorated with mosques and minarets. They're kind of hard to see. There's one over here. The call to prayer happens five times a day. So, you know, it's 2 in the morning and they're going to have a call to prayer, and another one at, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock, and another at noon, and another at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and another at 5 o'clock, whatever. It's just this constant call to prayer. And all of these minarets and all of these different mosques are there, and they all go off at the same time. So wherever you are, there's 4 or 5 mosques within earshot. And they all now have these modern, you know, speaker systems where, and it's all tape recorded. So the imam goes up and just flips a switch, and you hear the call to prayer from 5 or 6 different places at once, just making sure that it's covered. I couldn't find the picture, but I have a picture that, to me, was really interesting. We were preparing for Passover. One of the students, and this was several years ago, was sitting in the window. He had opened his window, and there's a ledge, and he was sitting in the window, and he's reading his Bible preparing for Passover, and there is a minaret in the background. And at the time I took the picture, there was a call to prayer. So the Muslims have a call to prayer going on while one of our guys was reading his Bible preparing for the Passover service that night. It was just a kind of a juxtaposition of two different religions. We are even told there, because Christianity is not looked at real favorably, when we do our church services and we sing hymns, etc., keep the windows closed, don't make a big deal out of it or whatever, because, you know, we still want to do it, but we just don't want to flaunt it. So we're very careful what we do. This is one of the museums, and again, it's very hard to see, but there's some of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Qumran used to be under Jordanian rule, so there, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, some of them came over into Jordan. So you can see some of the scrolls, some fragments of the scrolls, and then some of you don't know this, but a lot of the Dead Sea Scrolls are actually in copper. So they beat out copper plates, and then they carved words into copper. And so a lot of those, again, were rolled up. So you see them kind of rolled up like a scroll, but they're actually made out of copper. So you can visit the museum in Amman and see examples of the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's another picture of either the copper, or this down here I think is leather. Very interesting stuff. This is the amphitheater, to give you an idea of how big ancient Amman or ancient Rabbah was. There is usually a 1-to-10 ratio. In Roman times, they wanted one seat in the amphitheater for every 10 people that were in the city. This amphitheater seats 4,000 people, so ancient Amman or ancient Rabbah would have been around 40,000 people, which is big, considering you've got to have an infrastructure that supports water and waste removal and all of that. So this was a very thriving place. If you've ever been to some place like this, you can stand down on a stage and you can have someone all the way up at the top, and you can just talk in a normal voice and say, "Can you hear me?" And they can hear every word you say, but just because of the natural acoustics. There's no electricity there. An actor, as long as the people are quiet, you can hear an actor just whispering from stage. And the way this would have worked, you can see this behind here. The cover is gone. There used to be a cover of wood and animal skins or whatever. But this was where the actors would go back and change, and then they would come through the door and out onto the stage. Most of the time when they did a play, one person would have 4 or 5 parts and would hold a mask. In fact, that the word facade, it comes from the mask that people hold. So an actor would do his part with some mask, he would go back, and then he would change into some other clothes, come out with a different mask for this new character that he or she was, well, would have been a guy that he was playing. Back in these days, even the female parts were played by men, because the females were not allowed to be on stage. So anyway, this is an amphitheater. This is the Bunyat Center. This is the area where Cody Lynn from the Laurel congregation. Tom Diaz's granddaughter is there right now, along with several others. And I'm going to go see Cody pretty soon when we go there. I'm going to visit the Bunyat Center. The center was started by Princess Sarbath. Just if you know anything about the way mentally handicapped children are treated in other areas of the world, it's very interesting. When Princess Sarbath was a young lady, she knew that there was a lot of mistreatment of children. In fact, if you had a child, you wanted a boy, and boys were good. If you had a girl, sometimes they would even get rid of the girls because I don't want girls, I want boys, because boys are, you know, like money. But if you have someone that has a learning disability, boy, that was really frowned upon. They got to the place where they made laws in the country that you can't euthanize or do away with them. So what do you do with a child that you don't want and is an embarrassment to you because, you know, it's just to have a child like this was an embarrassment. So parents would often just lock them in closets, and they would never see the light of day. They'd feed them, and they just would stay in the closet. Princess Sarbath comes along and says, I want to change the perception. These kids do have value. So she started this school, a special ed school. It's the first one in Jordan. And what she would do is bring these kids here and then teach them things so that they could be useful at home. For severely handicapped children, they come to school every day and they practice how to put on your coat and take your coat off, how to sit down and use a spoon or a fork so that you're not as much of a burden to your parents, right? They teach them that. For the kids that have a learning disability but have the ability to work, they teach them how to wash dishes, how to cook food, how to be a maid in a hotel, change beds, etc. And some of these children that would have been ostracized or kept in a closet are now working and productive. And this is all a part of Princess Sarbath. Here is an example of the school. So here are some of the ladies that are taking care of these mentally handicapped children. I went there when I took this picture. I went there and I spent the day. I spent about 6 hours there. And these kids are starving for attention, because over there, if you have a disability like this, people don't touch you. You're not hugged. You're not held. You're not cared for. You're ostracized. And so I walk in there, and I was told before I went in there, you shouldn't touch the kids. The parents don't like that. Well, I threw caution to the wind, and I hugged everybody because I'm a hugger. And they just latched onto you. It was just the most interesting thing in the world. So I sat down on the floor with a couple of these kids and colored with them all day. And they just loved it. It was just so exciting for them to be able to have this opportunity. So they go there to school. They're fed. All of that. It's just a wonderful thing. They have a book there. I thought I would show this to you. You might recognize that signature. This was when Mr. Armstrong first got involved. He writes, a new and heartwarming experience to visit this school. This is March 30th of 1982. It is a mission of love to the handicapped who need that love and training so sorely, and an important contribution to the whole society as well. I will count it a privilege to have a small part by a grant from the Ambassador Foundation and assign Herbert Armstrong. So we are still there. Corey Erickson is the one that runs the program today. With the exception of just a few years, we have been sending students over there to work in the Bunyat Center. In fact, one of the wings in the Bunyat Center, we made a sizable donation back in the days when Mr. Armstrong was still alive to be able to build that wing. So, very nice. All right, going a little further, this is now Jerash. This is an ancient area that is being remodeled or redone. So a lot of times when you go to ruins, they leave them as ruins. The city of Jerash decided that they would try and restore it to the way it would have looked back in Roman times. So they take a building, this is an example of it, and again, it's a little hard to see, but where there is the original stone, it's still there, but where a stone is missing, they are making a perfect piece to be able to fit back in, so they are rebuilding this building to make it look like it did in ancient times. And they're doing it the old-fashioned way, with a hammer and a chisel, and there are dozens of men sitting down there, and they've got this spot where their rock is going to go And they go and they take their measurements, and then they come back and they sit down and tink, 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 tink. And they go back every once in a while and measure, and they come back, tink, 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 tink. And it may take a couple of weeks to make one stone. And then they put it in place, and they go and they measure the next stone. And then they go and tink, tink, tink. And they are rebuilding this town one stone at a time. It's fascinating to watch. This will be going on for decades, I'm sure. And probably, this was back in 2005, probably a lot of that building is now done. All right, this is an area that I wanted to spend just a little bit of time on to describe. This is the ancient site of Pella. So Pella may not be something that comes directly to mind if you've never seen Pella. Pella is an area where the church that was in Jerusalem fled after the Roman conquest. They had to leave Jerusalem and they fled to Pella. So the story is, and again, this is a story, I believe it's true, but I have to put it in that context, that the church that was in Jerusalem at the time was given a warning by an angel, and the angel told them, leave right now and go to Pella. And so the church spread the news around, an angel has told us that we're to leave, and so they got out of Dodge, as it were, out of Jerusalem, just prior to the Romans taking over and destroying it, and they lived for a period of about 3.5 years in Pella. We were able to go there. We actually had a church service there during the Feast of Tabernacles. They've got an ancient ruin that's kind of got a little covered area where you could sit in, and we had church services in Pella. Luke 21 talks about that time. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. So if you're in Jerusalem, you would go across the Jordan Valley, up into the mountain range that was on the Jordanian side, up into the town of Pella. All right, just a couple of more things here. We're getting close to the end. I wanted to show you the excavation site that many scholars today think is ancient Sodom. So when you go to an area and you see a mound, everything there is pretty flat. So when you see a mound of dirt, it usually means there's something underneath. And they call them tells. So this is one of the places that is, it's just south or just north of the Dead Sea and south of where the crossing is for the El Allenby Bridge. And there's this tell or this mound. The University of Phoenix and some other places that have a religious program, a Christian program, decided to go over there and start exploring this because some scientists got together and said, this may be that ancient site of Sodom. And when they started digging there, they found things that make them believe that this is ancient Sodom. We were there the first year, so what you're going to see is kind of virgin territory that is just being excavated. But this is an area that is in the plain of Jordan, and this tell is thought to be ancient Sodom. A place today is called Tell El Hammam, H-A-M-M-A-M. You could look that up and find some modern pictures of it. This is up on the very top. All ancient cities had a wall. So this is an ancient wall. And so the city would have been up high. And then you see all this dirt fill. When a city is destroyed, often the Romans would come and build a siege mound against the site of it so that they could walk up and take over. But this ancient wall here goes down 30 or 40 feet to the ground. And I'm going to show you some pictures from on top here. Again, everywhere you go, this is all pottery that's been littered. This is a frieze from the top of a building that's actually got paint on it that's still there, a fresco-type paint. Again, you can just see this stuff littered. If you look around here, it's also interesting. When you think of raining fire and brimstone, if you dig in this area, this is sulfur. The place even smells like sulfur. It just still has that volcanic smell to it. Now, whether God sent down an asteroid or whatever he did, or whether it was actually fire from heaven, this place burnt. And there is evidence here that this city was destroyed by fire. Whether it's ancient Sodom, I don't know. I show a picture here on the side. There is a plant there that grows. Our tour guide, who did not know this, I don't think the story behind it, but I asked him what this plant was. And he says, oh, that's Lot's apple. So that's what they call this plant, Lot's apple. It's poisonous. You can't eat it. But if you know the story of Lot, and remember Lot was in Sodom, and the angel said, you have to leave. So this plant that is around this tell, and there's a lot of this out there, there's a plant out there called Lot's Apple, so, for what it's worth. All right, I want to show you a couple more maps here. Again, I know this is a little hard to see. This is during the time of the Exodus where you got the Amorites, the Moabites, the Edomites. And then today, or during New Testament times, you would have seen the Galilee region. This is where we're going to go with the students on the first day of Unleavened Bread. Samaria, which was northern Israel, and then Judea, southern Israel. And then this area here, you see it, Nabatea, that's where Petra is. And this is the area of Jordan. It was called Transjordan at the time. So let's read a little bit about this. Exodus 20, or Ezekiel 25. Just read this quickly. There's three things written about Ammon, Moab, and Edom that I'll just read. The word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face against the Ammonites, and prophesy against them, and say to them, Hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God, Because you said, Aha, against my sanctuary, when it was profaned, and against the land of Israel, when it was desolate, and against the house of Judah, when they went into captivity. Indeed, therefore, I will deliver you as a possession to the men of the east. And he says the same thing in verse 8 about Moab. And this happened. The Ammonites, the Edomites, the Moabites were all taken into captivity. I think that God, if they would have blessed Israel as they went through, yes, you're our cousins, you're our relatives, you pass on through, just, you know, don't take all our water and all our livestock and leave our people alone, but pass through. I think God would have blessed them, but he caused them to go into captivity. And you can see the same thing, again, I won't read it here, but Edom did the same thing in taking vengeance against the house of Judah. As a result, this area would have gone into captivity. What we have now in its place, we still have Bedouins that are there, but the race of people that are there now. In fact, if you didn't know this, the king, King Abdullah, King Hussein, all of those that are of the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan that are current rulers, are direct descendants of Muhammad. In fact, they are the most direct descendants of Muhammad. And as a result of that, they have the right to the kingly line of the nation of Jordan. So just in case you didn't know that, right? The direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad are the leadership in Jordan. Okay, just a couple more slides here. I wanted to just show this to give you an idea of what Jordan and Israel are surrounded by. So this area is Arabic and Muslim. This area in Europe here, this is what we think will be a part of the 10-nation Europe, the kings of the north. So you've got the kings of the north, you've got the kings of the south, you've got the Gog and Magog. All of those play into end-time prophecy. And then stuck right in the middle of that, this little green sliver is Israel, and this kind of brown area right here is Jordan. Right in the middle of this mix, when the king of the north and the king of the south and the hordes from the east, they're all right in the middle. But I'd like to read something interesting about what's going to happen there. And one of the reasons, again, why Mr. Armstrong would have thought, well, maybe perhaps Petra would be the place where we would be protected, because when we read through prophecy, you're going to see that these areas do get protection during this time. So let's read this. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south will attack the king of the north. The king of the north will come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and ships, and will enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Then he will also enter the glorious land. So we're going to go into the nation of Israel. And many countries will be overthrown, but these will escape from the king of the north's hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. The nation of Jordan is prophesied to not fall into the hands of the king of the north. Isn't that interesting? Why? I think you'll see in just a moment. Remember I said that when God chastised Edom and Ammon and Moab in the Old Testament and they went into captivity, it was because they didn't bless Israel. You're going to see Jordan has a very different relationship with them. Verse 42, he will stretch out his hand against the countries, against the land of Egypt even will not escape. And he will have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt. The Libyans, the Ethiopians will fall at his heels. But news of the east and the north will trouble him, and he'll go out with great fury to destroy those things. Anyway, so all of these nations are getting destroyed except the nation of Jordan. Why is the nation of Jordan protected during this period of time? Now, one thing might be, well, if that's where the people of God go, like they did in 70 and 80 AD when they had to flee from the invading Roman armies, they went to Pella. Pella is in Jordan. They were allowed to go there. But I think you'll see something else interesting. I wanted to show this as a quote. This is King Abdullah II. He's the current ruler. This is what he was quoted as saying. We have peace with Israel. Now think about that from the Arab perspective. Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, they all want Israel wiped off the face of the earth, but not Jordan. We have peace with Israel. We're actually the last man standing. When you look at all of the Arab countries that surround them, Jordan is like a buffer zone for Israel. So there is going to be immense pressure and people asking, why do we have this relationship when it is not benefiting anybody? Why are we friends with Israel? He answers the question. Obviously, my answer is you always benefit from peace. The nation of Jordan is at peace with Israel. They have a very good relationship. When you look at the rest of the Arab world and the problems that they're having, I think that if this continues on, I think that God will bless the nations of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, because they did support and will support Israel and may support even the church at some point in time. I think it's important that we keep the relationship going with the royal family. I think that's a big deal, something that I hope we will continue to do. Anyway, I thought I would just, I'll end with that. This again is another picture of the monastery up in Petra. Hopefully this will give you a little idea of the kingdom of Jordan, not only in history, but as well as prophecy. And give you an idea as you read through the Bibles, when you read about Edom, Moab, and Ammon, you'll know that those are the areas that are now today modern-day Jordan.